Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for listening to the Evening Edition. So if you're anything like me, you don't just love watching movies, you also love listening to two complete strangers jabber on about movies. You know, dissecting those themes, comparing and contrasting, digging deep, getting all meta, showing off their deep and profound knowledge of cinema. Which is why you need to check out the all-new At The Movies podcast with my buddy Umapagan Ambige Pagan. I really think he loves talking about movies more than he does watching them. And to listen, just log on to bfm.my/movies. Hey everyone, I'm Ezra Zayed, and this is Finding the Funny. Finding the Funny is where we'll be speaking to and sometimes speaking about people who are in this funny business of entertainment and comedy. So be it stand-up comics, writers, hosts, actors, and beyond, we'll be discussing everything from their work, their inspirations, and what decisions and relationships impacted their craft.
All right. And I get a little bit nervous with a lot of white people in bright lights because I'm Japanese. I feel like I'm on a battleship signing an apology or something.
Sorry to bomb the harbor.
Well, that's what we do. That's what Japanese people do. We apologize all the time. You ever bumping them in time?
Oh, sorry.
That's what we do. We're genetically disposed to apologize, and that's what it is. You know, like how the brothers, they're good at sports and they got rhythm, right? And how the white dudes don't have rhythm and can't play sports. That's what we do. We apologize. Try this. Find the Japanese tourist herd and bumping them on purpose. They will apologize.
Oh, sorry. My horror, so sorry.
Find the biggest one you can, give him a good right hook to the head. Just pop, oh, sorry!
Didn't mean for you to hit me right in the eyeball. How's your fist? Good? Okay, sorry.
Be over there.
My guest tonight, Paul Ogata. Born and raised in Honolulu in Hawaii, he now headlines shows from around the globe, from Hong Kong to Hollywood, from Tokyo to Times Square. And in 2007, he won the San Francisco International Comedy Competition, an event whose past champs include people like Sinbad and Dana Carvey. But more recently, he performed in Kuala Lumpur at the Crack House Comedy Club, where in attendance was a very special guest. Have a listen to our conversation. Paul Ogata, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's probably not your first and probably not your last time here in KL, but you're traveling, you know, going back and forth between, you know, North America and Southeast Asia. That's the life of a comedian right now in 2016.
Yeah, it's become a real global industry. So I'm doing shows in Africa. I'm doing shows in most of 6 of the 7 continents, really.
Was that always the case? Was that something that you envisioned, was being a comedian in the United States, was you know, hitting all of these cities and hitting all of these bars and clubs? Did it go beyond that?
When I first started, I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could just travel the world and tell jokes? But that wasn't the case back when I started. It was basically, if you were an American comedian, you did comedy in America, and that's it. But slowly, other places and other markets began to open up, and it's great now. I see the world.
What's really fascinating is that your audiences, I mean, it changes so quickly because people are not just consuming you live on stage, but if they know that you're coming, they're going to do a quick YouTube search of Paul Ogata. Do I find him funny? Actually, I do. I'm going to buy him a ticket. And it changes the expectation as well.
Yes. There was a gentleman who saw a video clip and came to the show last night, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Malaysia. It was really interesting to see him there. It would be like seeing Joe Biden at a show in America. The former vice, I mean, he's the current vice president, soon to be former vice president. But it's comedy's such a global and a universal thing that everyone enjoys a laugh, no matter where you are, what position you have in the world. It's an important thing.
I mean, let's just look into that very, very quickly. Does that throw you or any other comedian off when there is a high-profile person in the audience? I know that just, you know, performing, whether it's in a club or a stadium, there is, I guess, an adjustment as to how the comedian approaches the stage. But when there is someone high-profile, does it change it at all?
I am more put off my game when family is at the show.
Of course.
When my dad's sister is in the audience and I see her making eye contact with me, and there's things I want to say, but I'm afraid to say now because my family's there or my grandma's in the audience. That throws me off more than if I see politicians, high-ranking politicians. Last year when I was here, the prime minister's brother was in the audience. And Tony Fernandez was in the audience. And I think that's cool. It didn't throw me off, but I thought it was very cool.
Does it check your thoughts as to what's happening in your brain to what's escaping your mouth? Or does it just vibe quite naturally?
Yeah, it all flows together. The way I approach comedy, and everyone does it differently. Some people memorize an act from the beginning to the end and they repeat it verbatim from A to Z. I don't do that. I tend to see what happens. And, last night when the former deputy prime minister was in the audience, the show revolved around that a little bit. So I don't shy away from anything. If anything, it feeds it more.
Did it have a good laugh, at least?
Yeah. And he's a good guy. We had a laugh afterwards.
Turning the clock back a little bit, when you first started, I mean, I've got here in my notes that you used to be a radio DJ in Honolulu and you're originally from Hawaii. Is that right?
I was born and raised in Hawaii. I lived my whole life there. And then I moved to California about 10 years ago to do comedy full time. While I lived in Hawaii, yes, I did a morning radio show in Honolulu.
And what was your radar as to, approaching being involved in media or being in front of a microphone? Was it something that you always wanted to do? Was it something that your parents were hoping that you would end up being something else in terms of a profession?
Well, especially if you're a Japanese-American kid growing up in Hawaii, there's a lot of things your family pushes you into becoming. You got to be an engineer. You got to be a lawyer or this and that.
That sentence right there, being a Japanese American being raised in Honolulu, is that an interesting combo right there?
You know what it is, and Hawaii is a very cosmopolitan place. It's probably the most diverse place I've ever been to. That being said, Japanese are the largest percentage of the population there, and so the pressure is on from your family to do. Important things, serious things, definitely not getting up on stage and telling jokes things. But so I was originally in the College of Electrical Engineering at the University of Hawaii.
Wow.
And
Mom and Dad were proud?
Well, I don't know if they were proud, but they were like, okay, he's doing what he's supposed to do. And then I discovered that it's really not for me. I began doing stand-up at night when I was in college. And I found out that's what I really wanted to do with my life. It was always something I was really good at when I was a kid.
Always, being the funny guy.
Yeah, voted the most comical in the class. But it wasn't something I thought that I really wanted to do. It was just something I was good at and I enjoyed doing. I originally wanted to be a magician.
That's fun.
When I was a kid, yeah. But it slowly dawned on me that magic is a lie.
Just the sleight of hand, the illusion.
Right. Nothing a magician is showing you is real. It's all a lie.
Right.
It's all you agree as the person watching magic to be amazed that he is smarter than you and he's tricking you. And it's all a lie. But comedy is about truth. And that really struck me that, wow, this is it's sort of the opposite.
And were you making jokes in those early days about these particular observations, or were you just sharing it and people started laughing at it? What was the thing that triggered it?
Well, when I was a kid, a really young kid, maybe 8 or 9 years old, that's when I wanted to be a magician. And I had all of the tricks that you can buy at the store. And I would perform at family parties.
Deck of cards.
Deck of cards. Magic top hat.
Oh, that's a bunny coming out of it.
Yeah, not a bunny, but the thing, things would come out. I'd have the Chinese linking rings.
Wow.
And all of those hokey magic tricks. And I did that for a while. And then that kind of got pushed to the side with the after my parents said, you got to get more serious about school. You got to. And once again, they reined me in. But over the years, I began to realize, there's more truth in comedy than anything.
More after this with Paul Agata on Finding the Funny right here on BFM 89.9.
Bigotry Free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
You're tuned in to Finding the Funny. I'm Ezra Zayed. Tonight, we're featuring Paul Agata. He's an actor, comedian from the United States with appearances on Comedy Central and CBS's The Late Late Show credited to his name. And as we continue our conversation, I ask him if the funny gene was something that was passed on to him through his family or whether there was something about Honolulu that shaped his perspective.
Oddly enough, no one in my family is funny. Precisely zero people in my family are funny. And so I don't know where I get it from. I think it was more of a nature finds a way.
To disrupt the system a little bit.
Yes, I am.
The big man upstairs is looking at the Agata family saying, look, we gotta mix it up.
Yeah, we need some entropy. And that's where I guess the comedy comes from. And you can't just have generations of serious people. That's what happened, I think.
So you're doing a couple of, I guess, stand-up comedy gigs, open mic nights. Is that how you start off? And at which point did it go, well, I'm not doing this as a hobby anymore. I'm doing this 2-3 nights a week. I'm doing this with some regularity now.
I took a job at the local comedy club for a while. There was just one comedy club in Hawaii.
And was there a scene that accompanied that club, or was it just a club?
It was a very small scene. There were maybe 5 of us local comedians. If that, maybe 4. And they would fly comedians in from California every week. So there wasn't much of a scene. And because of that, I didn't really improve. I was horrible for a long time. Just terrible.
Or did you just think that, hey, I'm pretty good just around these 4 comedians?
That's exactly it. There's not much, no one's there to push you to be better because it was such a small scene. And
People were buying tickets and they were laughing.
Yeah. Well, you know, they weren't coming to see us. They weren't coming to see the local comedians. They were coming to see the comedians that flew in from Hollywood or California, New York. And I was terrible for so long because, as you said, it was just a cool thing that I could do.
But when you say you were terrible in the range or in the scope of material that you're playing with, or is it you were terrible because you just didn't have enough hours on stage? What was it, you think?
Everything. You've got 1 week of shows and 5 local comedians to grab those spots. So oftentimes it would be you'd get on a show 1 week and then you wouldn't work for another month. And you can't get better if you don't do it. Comedy is the only thing really that you get better at by doing it publicly. You can speak in front of a mirror at home all you want, but you're not going to get better as a comedian. You need that interaction, that feedback, that instant feedback from the audience. When doctors are training to be brain surgeons, they're forced to cut open cadavers, cut open dead people's heads. Not in comedy. We're out there. We're cutting heads open on live people every night.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult thing, but it's my favorite thing in the world now.
And did you make it out to California? Did you make it out to all of these clubs that everybody's familiar with in the U.S.?
Yes. I was, as I said, terrible for a long time. And then the comedy club in Hawaii shut down. So there were no comedy clubs.
Wow.
And I decided, I'm going to open a comedy club. That way I'll have somewhere to perform and my friends will. And Hawaii can have more comedians. And I found out a very valuable lesson that I am a horrible business person. I had no business opening a comedy club. It ran for a year, then it folded, and it was a valuable lesson. But because after that, I got really serious about comedy, and that's when I got a job as a morning radio host, and it all fed each other. And the Laugh Factory, which is one of the biggest clubs in America, opened a spot in Waikiki, and because of my job at the radio station, I became the the default house MC for the club.
And that was a great opportunity to try out new material and figure your way out.
Yes. And the owner from the Hollywood Club, Jamie Masada, heard some good things about me and flew into Waikiki to see. And he said, I'll help you out. Then he got me a spot on a television show, a role in a Damon Wayans film. And I would fly back and forth between Hawaii and Los Angeles more and more to do comedy. And I thought, and that's the point where I thought, I really got to make the move now or never do it.
What is it about? I mean, I've spoken to quite a few comedians, especially those from the US, and the landscape of how entertainment works is it boils down to this one moment where I've got to make the move. And so, you know what? If you want to be somewhere for comedy, you got to make the move out to Hollywood, or you got to make it move to Sunset Strip.
Yes, simply because that's where the business is. You can't thrive in business if you're not in it. And so you've got to either be in New York City or Los Angeles for comedy or show business. So that's the decision I was faced with. Do I stay in a comfortable position where I was getting paid very well to do a morning radio show, and I had everything that I needed? I had a house, I had a wife and cars and dogs.
And stability.
Stability.
Yeah.
I had no worries about bills. Was I chasing my dreams? Was I fulfilling that part of me? And the answer, after a long, hard look, was no. That all that other stuff is not important. I'm very, very fortunate to do what I love for a living, to get paid to do what I love. And I wish everybody could do that. Find what they love and find a way to monetize that.
And what's interesting is that even in that comfortable and privileged position that you were in, you still felt that you had an extra gear to offer. And sometimes, you know, even if those things line up, it doesn't actually happen. But you felt as a comedian that, well, there are things that I haven't actually quite worked out that could be really exciting. Did you feel that within your material? What were you playing with in terms of your material that you thought, well, this is something that Paul Ogata can tell, not somebody else can?
Hawaii is such a unique place in that, as I mentioned earlier, it's got a quite diverse population. And the reason why it's so diverse is back in the 1800s, the sugarcane industry was big in Hawaii, and they brought laborers in from all these other countries, from the Philippines, from China, from Japan, from Portugal. And the way that everyone from these disparate countries got together and were able to coexist was through making fun of each other. And this ethnic humor is huge in Hawaii.
And it's also, I guess, a different variety of ethnic humor, not necessarily the Caucasian African American variety, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. It's broader with its
with nuances.
Targets. Yes.
Yeah.
With nuances, and it's not malicious. A lot of people will take umbrage against ethnic humor in Hawaii and say that it's racist, and it's not racist. It's racial.
Yes.
It pertains to race, but it's a means of drawing people together. Whereas a lot of times with the black people do this, white people do that, that's more divisive.
Yeah.
And it's designed to separate people. But in Hawaii, sure, you make fun of somebody, but it's part of like a gang jumping in process, I guess. It's part of a ritual, a hazing ritual.
And I guess when you're performing either in L.A. or New York and, you know, you're coming up on stage, they hear the name Paul Ogata, they say, all right, we've got, I guess, a Japanese-American comedian. That's one thing to digest. Oh, this guy's from Hawaii, so he's bringing that thing as well. It's, you know, I think audiences like to pigeonhole comedians and figure out where they fit in terms of humor, but it's a lot harder when Paul Ogata's coming on stage, is it?
Yeah, well, obviously people judge a book by its cover, so when I walk out, they see an Asian guy, and they say, oh, well, he's just going to talk about Asian people. Here's an interesting story. I was performing at a club in Southern California, and my face and bio was on the website of the comedy club, and a woman had called up during the off hours to get information, but the club was closed. So she still was on the line. She forgot to hang up, and she was talking to her husband, and she said, do you want to see this guy? It's Paul Ogata. Oh, he's Asian. There's going to be a lot of Asian people there.
Shall we go?
Yeah. Are we going to understand him? It was horrible. If you go to my website, paulogata.com, there's a link to the club owner gave me the audio file. And so now I animated it and set it on YouTube, and you can watch it on my website.
I hope. But I guess you didn't turn up to the show then.
We don't know.
Oh,
we don't
gosh.
Know. And it goes. It went on for like 5 minutes. I've edited it down, and you can catch a shortened version. But so people come in with that that baggage already when they see me. Oh, here's a guy. Are we even going to understand him because he looks Asian? So there's that. And if they hear that I'm from Hawaii, then they're like, oh, he's just going to talk about coconuts or whatever.
Yeah, and Mai Tais.
Yeah, Mai Tais. But they don't ever do that when a white comedian comes on. They're never like, oh, he's from Wisconsin. All we're going to hear about is cheese.
Mm.
They just say, oh, here's a comedian. This is what a comedian should look like. In their minds, they're thinking that.
Woo. So watch for me in the next Damon Wayans movie. It comes out in December or January. It's called Behind the Smile. I almost didn't do the movie. They called me. It was like, hey, Paul, we heard some good stuff about you. We want you in the movie. I said, great. I'll be right there. What part do I play? He said, we want you to play this crazy Asian chop socky guy. Can't pronounce his L's and R's. Your name's going to be Karate Man. Great. I told him, look, first of all, it's pronounced karate. It's not pronounced karate, okay? Second of all, I'm tired of the way Asians are portrayed in the media. It's always some stupid buffoon type of... Remember in the Charlie Chan days back when films first started? It wasn't even a Chinese guy. It was just a fat white dude with his eyes taped back. And that's wrong! Then they moved on to David Carradine in Kung Fu. He's not even half Chinese. Well, how did that audition go? We're looking for somebody who can mispronounce their L's and R's. You got a lisp? Fine, that'll do. And I think that's vile and it's wrong, I told the guy. You change your script or count me out. He said, well, it's 10,000. I said, look, when you rank me, catch a brain. I run to my reins quickly.
Don't go anywhere. More with Paul Agata on Finding the Funny right here on BFM 89.9. Hey, I hope you're really enjoying this podcast. Well, you must be. You've made it this far. Anyway, when you're done listening to this one, don't forget to check out At the Movies with my buddy Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan. It'll satisfy all your movie podcast cravings, but only after you're done listening to this one. Remember, it's bfm.my/movies. Welcome back to Finding the Funny. I'm Ezra Zayed, and we're featuring actor-comedian Paul Agata from the United States. And as we continue our conversation, first, here's a clip off YouTube, and he's speaking at a TEDx event in Hong Kong.
This is what I learned from my dad. My dad was a frugal guy, and he grew up poor. He grew up way worse than poor, but he scratched and he clawed his way up to broke, and then he had children. This is what he taught me. We used to beg him for the latest video games. I remember when I was a kid, Atari first came out. The first Atari 2600. It was just horrible looking back on it now. Just I'm a character. You're a square. But we wanted that. We're like, Dad, we didn't even just want it. We needed that. Dad, we need that new video game. And my dad, who was a hippie and also Asian American, sat me down and schooled me using math and the Beatles. Here's what he said. Son, sit down. You don't need a video game. That's what he said. He said, here's what the Beatles said, right? The love you take is equal to the love you make. Expressed mathematically, that's X plus love equals X minus love. Solving for love, that's 2 times love equals X minus X, or love equals 0. The Beatles also said, all you need is love. And since we know love equals 0, all you need is nothing. Nothing is all you need.
2006 is, especially, I guess, in with comedy and how YouTube videos, I guess, started to sort of penetrate people's awareness about stand-up comedy. That would have been a very crowded scene, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, it still is.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. But I think, you know, within the comedy world, like, you know, before YouTube and after YouTube a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that a fair thing?
Sure. It's very much the rise of Russell Peters.
That's right. I mean, everybody uses that as a reference point as to how the comedy game has changed.
World has changed. Yeah. How here's a guy who was good at what he did, but labored in relative obscurity until someone posted a video of him on YouTube. And there's a lot of analogs to this, whether it's the crazy person at the gas station who yelled at other people and went viral, and it probably changed that person's life. Well, I mean, this changed Russell Peters' life for the way, way better.
Yes. And how cognizant of that were you in terms of wanting to progress with your career? Like, were you thinking, well, you know, let's try and do different things, do maybe a TV pilot? Were you just trying your hand at everything, or did you have a particular approach? Well, you know what, I think I just want to improve on my craft as a stand-up comedian.
That's exactly what I thought. I thought, I just want to be the best stand-up comedian that I could be and be the funniest guy that I could be. If something came about, like those the TV spots or the movie roles that I already did, that's great because it would just feed back into doing stand-up. But you've got to, if you're going to make it in show business these days, you've got to be multidimensional. You can't just be a stand-up. You have to have scripts written. You have to have ideas for TV shows or movies. That's what the industry now wants. They want you to come to them with a plan to how you're going to be a star.
Right. So even if you're having a great 20-minute set on stage, an executive in the back row says, hey, Paul, loved your set. What else do you have? And that's almost an opportunity where you say, oh, actually, if you were prepared, that might be an opportunity to move on to something else.
Yeah. Very early on, after I moved to Los Angeles, I met just such a person.
Just at the back row.
A Hollywood power broker. And I'm not going to name names, but he saw me and he said, oh, let's have a meeting. And I said, oh, this is great. This is how it starts. And I showed up to his office and he said, tell me about what you want out of the business. And I said, I just want to be the best stand-up comedian that I could be. If nothing else happens to me in this world, but I travel the world being a great stand-up comic, I will be the happiest guy ever. He looked at me quietly, into my soul.
Oh, wow.
For 3 or 4 seconds. And he said, well, I can't help you. Goodbye.
What was the right answer for him to have sort of started putting his hands together and licking his lips? What was the answer he was looking for?
The answer he was looking for is what I just told you earlier, is that, I want to be a TV star, a movie star. I've got these, I've written scripts. I've written TV show ideas.
And just to basically milk everything out of you, I guess.
Yeah, wow. Because sure, I'm a funny guy on stage, but there's a gazillion funny people on stage. He wanted to know what else there was. How could I help him? You know, if I show up and I don't have any other ideas, then he has to find somebody with ideas. Then why does he need me? So that's a valuable lesson I learned early on.
And with that lesson, did it change your approach did it change how you looked at comedy in terms of how it manifested itself, not just as a 20-minute, 30-minute set on stage, but, well, actually, I can do an animated series, I can do this, I can do that. Did that excite you, or did that just clutter everything else?
Well, it first of all, it was like a punch in the gut. It was like
demoralizing.
It was like somebody had hit me in the head with a 2x4 piece of lumber, and that somebody was me. I did it to myself. I threw myself down the stairs pretty much on that day. But after that, I re-examined it. Once you stop crying behind the dumpster,
yeah,
and you shake yourself off,
yeah.
He had a great, valid point, and that's when I realized it. So since then, I've been developing TV show ideas. We took a travel comedy show idea I had. We filmed a pilot, actually, and we had meetings with several networks. And like anything, you have to have many ideas, because you'll throw 13 ideas at a wall.
One's going to stick.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah.
Perhaps zero will stick, and then you've got to come up with another 13 and throw it at the wall. So I was very lucky to move forward in the process with that idea. But unfortunately, it stalled, and so now I've got to throw 13 more things at the wall.
I've had the good opportunity to see you perform, and there are some comedians who, as you mentioned, come up with a script and stick to it to a T.
Yes.
There are other comedians who generally have a rough guide to it. But it's not just about the things that you say and the observations you make. You have an ace of spades with your physicality of it as well, whether it's the face that you make. Did it all come together all at once, or have these sort of little bits of ammunition come up gradually?
it's an ever evolving process. As a comedian, you're always growing, hopefully. So you'll discover, oh, this really works, and you'll add it to your repertoire of things that you do, and over time, your voice, your point of view changes as well. Who you are, what you believe will change, and that will inform your comedy as well.
It's interesting because now, you know, performing stand-up comedy is such a global thing. You're not limited to, as you mentioned, a particular continent. You're traveling to 6 out of 7 continents. How cognizant are you about the audience of where you are and how you cater the type of material? Because, you know, there are some comics who like to know a little bit about what's the temperature on the ground in that particular city so that it sort of informs a little bit about how they shape what they're going to say. Is that something that you consider as well?
Yeah, certainly. If you're new to a city, you should be more aware of what's happening and try to bring to the table something that will tie you and the audience together. But at a certain point, people will come to a show expecting to see you. And that's when you can throw everything out the window and just be you. If people are coming to a comedy show and you just happen to be a comedian there, well, then you have to play within those rules. But once people come to see you, oh, game on.
After this, we speak about being heckled, about bombing in front of an audience, and the process of crafting a joke. More with Paul Agata. This is Finding the Funny, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
This is Finding the Funny, and I'm Ezra Zayed. Here's the final part of my conversation with Paul Ogata, our featured guest this month. And I ask Paul about the proximity of being safe or conservative as a comedian. And what about those who choose to dance on a tightrope or push those boundaries? Is it something that a comic is always thinking about?
If you're a strategic comedian, sure. You don't want to...
Ooh, a strategic comedian. Are there a lot of those?
Well, there should be in anything, not just comedy, but in anything, in radio, in media, in accounting. Picture a Venn diagram where there are two circles. And if they don't intersect at all, and one circle is the comedian and the other circle is the audience. And if they don't intersect at all, that's probably a rookie or an open micer where the things the comedian wants to say has nothing to do with the thing the audience wants to hear. Now, as the circles join that lovely intersection of the two circles.
That hot spot.
Yeah. Oftentimes, that's within that little sliver, there is a portion of what you want to talk about and what they want to hear, and that's beautiful. And over time, hopefully, the circles unite, and everything you want to say is what they want to hear. And that's the goal of every entertainer, I think.
But also, I mean, just speaking about this connection with the audience, crowd work is something for you is quite natural. There isn't a fear to engage with somebody sitting on the front row. That brings a complete unpredictable element to the program, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's, I have more fun when I talk to the crowd than anything else I ever do. And it's a good testing ground for material, or breeding ground, actually. Sometimes you'll have an interaction with an audience member, and that will that moment will create in your mind a bit for later. You're like, oh, this was a funny thing that we came up with.
Also, just going back on that idea of the strategic comedian, it's also high risk in terms of if you're going to an area where you just don't know if anything will land.
You live by the sword, you die by the sword. I've had brilliant moments. I've done shows where the entire hour was just banter with me and the crowd, and that was amazing. However, I did have times where someone threatened my life.
I just want to hear that story. I'm sure the stories of you having great crowd work, we could hear that. But give me that bad moment right there.
I was talking to the crowd, and for some reason, I guess there was a German person in the crowd, and I was...
this is getting better already.
...faking a German accent and faking German words. So in the middle of this gibberish string of faux German, Hitler something, and this Jewish woman in the audience picked up on the word Hitler. And she exploded. I mean, after the show was over, she came up to me. She very quickly rushed over to me, finger jabbing me in the chest. And she said, if you ever say that word again, you are not leaving here alive.
And that was only something you didn't pick up on that during the actual moment itself? Or did you feel something?
I didn't see her. So there was no way for me to know what was wrong. If she was in the front row, perhaps that would be a different story. But I've had that. I've had a guy try to hit me with an empty wine bottle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Comedy is not supposed to be this aggressive.
It's not. But when you give people alcohol, and sometimes too much of it, bad things can sometimes happen.
But I don't imagine a heckler putting you off. How do you deal with that?
Hecklers are a lot like sharks. They sense fear. And when they feel like they can have the upper hand, that's when they will pounce. So a lot of times younger or newer comics will get attacked by hecklers. I certainly had my share when I first started out and was horrible, and they knew they could take me on. Sometimes they will just shout out things just to disrupt you because they know they can, or they think they can. And but nowadays people are... If they take me on, if they try to take me on at a show, they're going to lose.
Yeah.
much to my glee and the benefit of the other people in the crowd.
So just to talk a little bit more about, I guess, where you are going and where you're going with your craft. I mean, we can go through the awards and all the different places that you've performed, but is there something that you're working towards that you're really investing a lot of time towards?
Well, last year, I did shoot a one-hour special, so it was finally edited down, and it's now being shopped to several networks. Hopefully, that will be out soon, and people can see that. So now the task is writing the next hour. It takes a long time to write that first hour, and you really don't want to let it go as a comic because it's not that it's a crutch, but it's your child. You created this. You created this hour of jokes. But then at a certain point, people are like, well, okay, we heard that. What else do you have?
What's your process in... Oh, man, you went straight to the hour. I was going to go, what's your process in crafting a good 20 minutes? But is it something where you are very precious about it and make sure that it's teased out over a longer period of time? Or do you just sort of throw them away after, you know, X amount of time?
I wish I was like that. I wish... There are comedians who are so prolific. Bill Burr, for instance, or Louis C.K., George Carlin... was the prime example of this. He would create a brand new HBO special, a one-hour HBO special every other year. I don't know how many HBO specials he had.
He had plenty.
Too many to count. And that was a testament to his prolific nature. Most comedians will write their 20 minutes and hang on to that and not let it go. And I was like that for a long time. But now I want to explore and see what else there is for me to talk about.
But now that you're more experienced in the performing and the writing aspect, has that creative approach changed? Is it because you know what tools you can use and what bits you can and can't utilize?
Yeah. More than that, though, I think it's a process of finding out who you are as a person who wants to share your ideas. If you don't know what your ideas are, then you are talking about the differences between cats and dogs and why men dance different if their skin color is different. But there's so much more to talk about. And once you find out who you are, that opens it up. That opens the world up to you.
Because the job is such an interesting thing because it's so dependent on your taste. And you can't legislate taste, right? And you're throwing your taste out there to the audience and they're going to go... I don't know. Maybe I like a little bit of sweet. Maybe I like a bit of sour. And it's such an amazing gamble to say, well, this is the thing that I'm preparing. And, well, I hope you like it.
Yeah. I hate to quote Bill Cosby these days, but Bill Cosby did say that, I don't know the secret to success, but I do know the secret to failure is trying to please everybody. And so you can't worry about that someone in the audience was upset. You can't worry about that two people online wrote bad comments on your YouTube video. You just have to work your game and bring the people who like what you do to you.
Who do you admire in terms of some of the great comedians in your lifetime?
I was such a big fan of George Carlin. And the way that he could be silly, but turn on a dime and be very deep and have a message and still funny. And he could do both in the same show.
He could also do that and not be preachy because he was appealing to this other side of you that I guess still was willing to engage with the funny, because comedians like George Carlin can be somewhat divisive, but he, for much of his career, was really funny.
Yes. He did become a little preachy towards the end.
Yes.
But, you know, just a master of word craft. This guy would write everything down word for word, timed out perfectly. This is the kind of craftsman he was, that he could write his HBO special and he knew exactly how long it would take. He knew exactly what he was going to say.
Where the laughs were, how long.
What the beats were, yes. And I admire that. Not that I do any of that, but I do admire that. And I loved his comedy so much. But also Robin Williams. I like the way that whether it was insanity on stage or a carefully curated, orchestrated, choreographed insanity, which I thought was an even more delicious idea, that he could create this illusion of madness.
It sounds like you might be leading towards that idea. Do you think that's a little bit of, was part of his game a little bit? That, as you mentioned, controlled chaos?
Yes. A lot of people thought, wow, he's just saying stuff magically. But Robin was also a gifted performer. He was a trained actor. He went to Juilliard School in New York City, which is the finest acting school that there is. You know, Shakespearean trained. He was a genius. And he had so many things that he could pull from that made it look like it was lunacy when it was really just genius. And I like that. So I guess what I'm saying is, if I admire you, you'll probably be dead soon.
Yeah, right? I mean, based on those two examples.
Yeah.
You're going to be traveling for, I imagine, the foreseeable future. Life on the road, is it all that it's cracked up to be? Is it challenging on yourself, on your personal self and family? And because the business of comedy, now more than ever, it seems like it's cool again, if that makes sense. It's that sense of not just doing specials and YouTube bits. I mean, it's got this thing back now where if you're clocking in the number of clubs, is that the case for you?
I think it's always been the case for comedy nerds anyway. We like to see comedians come through clubs and we can see them in an intimate space in a room, getting back to intimacy again. Instead of, you know, you go to a Russell Peters concert, it's in a large arena. Oftentimes, you're watching Russell Peters on a television screen at an arena.
Yeah.
Well, you could have watched his YouTube thing at home. But because you want to be in the same room. It's no. There's something else. There's something magic about seeing someone in person, even if they're really far away.
Paul, thanks for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
If you missed any part of this program, download the podcast at our website, bfm.my, and search for Finding the Funny, where you'll find more episodes as well. I'm Ezra Zayed. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or black forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.